You're listening to the CyberWire Network, powered by N2K.
Hey, everybody. Today, I want to highlight a name that all of us know well, and that is our sponsor, Splunk. You need to keep operations humming around the clock, but potential disruptions are everywhere. Splunk helps you predict problems and find and fix issues fast so you can reduce risk and ditch downtime. The world's largest enterprises rely on Splunk's unified security and observability platform to become more efficient, resilient, and innovative. With Splunk, you can react quickly, evolve faster, and be ready for anything. Stay ahead of disruptions. Learn more at splunk.com/resilience. And we thank Splunk for sponsoring our show. In the complex world of enterprise identity, securing legacy web apps at scale can be daunting. Strata Identity makes it simple. With Strata, you can effortlessly integrate non-standard apps with any identity service, like MFA or SSO, with zero coding and zero hassle. Designed by identity architects for identity architects, Strata works with every vendor, standard, and app architecture. This means your apps can now speak modern protocols and integrate seamlessly with your chosen identity services. From securing on-prem web apps to migrating away from outdated identity providers or consolidating them, Strata helps you keep your complex access policies as you modernize your identity infrastructure and get rid of technical debt. Join leading organizations like 3M, Dallas County, and CIBC in securing your apps with Strata. Visit strata.io/cyberwire, share your identity security priorities, and receive a complimentary pair of AirPods Pro. Offer valid for organizations with over 5,000 employees. Connect today at strata.io/cyberwire. Tracking a group that's after the software supply chain. Israel adds airstrikes to the array of responses it's prepared to make to hackers. The U.S. Federal Trade Commission still doesn't know how you solve a problem like Mark. Some more notes from last week's Global Cyber Innovation Summit. Sophos has more details on Megacortex, a new strain of ransomware. And criminal organizations organize and operate a lot like legitimate businesses. From the CyberWire studios at DataTribe, I'm Dave Bittner with your CyberWire summary for Monday, May 6, 2019. Researchers at a number of firms, including Kaspersky, ESET, Avast, CrowdStrike, and Alphabet's Chronicle Security Unit, are tracking an increasingly aggressive and capable Chinese gang that's been hitting software supply chains. It's a bit unclear whether it's actually a gang or a unit controlled by Chinese intelligence and security organs. Variously called Barium, Shadowhammer, Shadowpad, or Wicked Panda, the group has, over the last few months, afflicted Piriform's backup tool CCleaner, apparently en route to its ultimate target, computer manufacturer Asus, NetSerang's enterprise remote management tool, and various online games. The goal appears to be espionage, and so speculation about attribution is trending toward a state actor, especially as evidence of interest in credential theft seems a Johnny-come-lately and perhaps a bit of 11th-hour misdirection. But focusing on the software supply chain in this way is troubling, and security researchers are pointing out that NotPetya started as a supply chain attack, too. The Jerusalem Post says a joint Shin Bet IDF operation prevented a Hamas cyber attack with an air attack on the Gaza headquarters of Hamas cyber operations. Forbes calls it a significant first, kinetic retaliation for a cyber attack, or perhaps kinetic preemption of an imminent cyber attack. The nature of the prospective cyber attack isn't clear. In the past, Hamas has shown mid-grade capability, some defacement and denial of service, and somewhat more sophisticated social engineering aimed at gaining access to information that could be developed into intelligence. An IDF spokesman is quoted in the Times of Israel to the effect that, quote, Hamas no longer has cyber capabilities after our strike, end quote. Shin Bet is said to have in some fashion neutralized the Hamas cyber capability, after which IDF aircraft destroyed the building that housed the operations. But the operational reality is both more complex and more conventional. Israel and the Palestinian Sunni Islamist militia have been engaged in active combat for the better part of a week, with Hamas firing an estimated 600 rockets into Israel and Israel responding with hundreds of airstrikes. It would probably be more accurate to regard Hamas cyber headquarters as one target in a larger air campaign, and the combat itself as another round in a war that's long had a cyber dimension. Cyber units will appear on target lists as other electronic warfare units have for decades. So to see the airstrike as exclusively a response to a cyber threat is a stretch. It was one strike in an extensive campaign. Nor is it the first, as ZDNet hints, at least not internationally. The U.S. killed ISIS hackers with a drone strike in 2015, as Defense Systems observed in contemporary accounts of American action against the caliphate. The U.S. Federal Trade Commission's enforcement action against Facebook remains up in the air. It's likely to be severe, but the New York Times reports that the form such severity will take, especially the nature of the penalties, if any, to be directed against CEO Zuckerberg himself, are believed to remain the subject of partisan disagreement within the commission. There's bipartisan skepticism of big tech, but disagreement over details. Late last week, an anonymous electric utility filed an electric disturbance report to the Department of Energy, indicating that some sort of cyber event had taken place. Blake Subcheck is a reporter at E&E News, and he's been leading the coverage of the story.
It's still a little bit hazy because we don't actually know the utility who initially filed this form. Obviously, that information is available to the Department of Energy and to other federal officials. But what DOE did share, what the Department of Energy did share, was that a denial of service condition was involved. And in fact, they also mentioned that it was not only any denial of service, but a denial of service that exploited a particular vulnerability. And they said that there was a patch already available for this vulnerability, and so the utility in question was able to apply that patch and get back up on its feet fairly quickly. They also were very careful to say that no power outages were involved, no actual disruption to power generation happened as a result of this cyber incident.
So things function the way that they were supposed to in case of an event like this, I suppose.
That's right. And the best that I was kind of able to glean in terms of details surrounding this was that a particular type of Cisco Adaptive Security Appliance product was involved. Now, Cisco declined comment on this. They said that they weren't aware of any reports. But of course, they're incredibly widely used, both network security devices and just routers. So my understanding is that there was some sort of denial of service condition instigated in these devices, likely positioned at the edge of some transmission network based on the geographic footprint that we know. And this would have triggered the filing with DOE. It would have been enough basically for the utility to say, oh, we're having trouble accessing these devices or peering into our own networks, so we're going to have to, you know, tip off regulators that something's wrong here. And when they did actually dig in, they discovered that some remote hackers had, exploited this vulnerability, triggered an equipment outage, but again, no actual blackouts associated with that. It sounds like the transmission grid and the power grid in that entire region was up and running when this happened on March 5th, and there were no service interruptions.
Hmm. Can you take us through how the Department of Energy categorizes things as a cyber attack, some of the nuances there? I understand there's a wide range of things that could fall into that category. Is that accurate?
That's correct. And this was part of the tricky nature of this story was, at least at first, there was a lot of fog of war around, okay, was this really a malicious hacking episode, or was this something perhaps more benign, or even a mistaken filing, which happens from time to time, and you know, the utility says something and then later discovers, well, actually, maybe that wasn't a cyber event. And there's no requirement that a cyber event actually be malicious in nature, or that it even has to come from remote hackers. So for instance, the first time that I actually noticed a utility file one of these and classify it as an actual cyber event, what ended up happening, this was something that affected Consumers Energy in Michigan in the beginning of 2018, And it was an employee who had been undergoing training and inadvertently got some escalated privileges on that particular training system and basically triggered a blackout for about 15,000 people. And that was classified as a cyber event because it had this element of unauthorized access. The employee wasn't supposed to get to that system. And it, you know, had a real actual grid disruption tied to it.
Where do you expect this to go from here? Do you expect more information to trickle out? Will there be clarity over the next days, weeks, months?
I do expect more information to come forward at some point. I filed for a Freedom of Information Act request as soon as I saw the cyber event listed. And sometimes the Department of Energy does opt to redact some portions of these OE-417 filings because they consider it to be sensitive, critical electric infrastructure information that shouldn't get out to the public. And I understand that. You know, the utility here is certainly concerned that maybe if the general public knew that this particular vulnerability was able to be exploited somewhat recently, that could invite future hackers or future interest from hackers. And so, you know, I definitely sympathize with the position of the federal government and certainly the utility industry that maybe it's best to keep a tight lid on some of the information surrounding these events. But on the other hand, I do think that with some of the lack of clarity surrounding, you know, precisely what happened and how such a wide geographic array of networks were apparently impacted, I do think that certainly the public deserves to know a little bit more about exactly what played out here. Certainly the North American Electric Reliability Corporation, as the main grid monitor and enforcer of cybersecurity rules, I have to imagine that they're going to be taking a very close look at this. And in fact, the Department of Energy disclosure that this utility in question didn't patch this vulnerability that was available for apparently quite a long time, that's the sort of thing that could invite regulatory scrutiny from the North American Electric Reliability Corporation. So I expect perhaps we haven't heard the last from them. And, you know, it wouldn't be hard to imagine regulators there pursuing some sort of fine or enforcement action against this utility if it did emerge that, you know, this vulnerability in some presumably pretty critical grid software just went unpatched for a long time.
That's Blake Subchak. He's a reporter at E&E News. We'll continue to share some notes and observations on the Global Cyber Innovation Summit held last Wednesday and Thursday in Baltimore. The symposium offered an overview of current and emerging threats and of the technology trends that both expose enterprises to such threats and offer the prospect of enhanced defenses. Estonia's ambassador at large for cybersecurity, Heli Tirma-Klaar, shared her country's experience as not only one of the most thoroughly digitized societies in the world, but as the victim of what's come to be generally regarded as the first cyber war, Russia's 2007 attacks against the networks of the Baltic Republic. She characterized it as the, quote, first politically motivated cyber campaign in history, end quote, and drew the lesson that good public-private partnership and solid expertise can work to build a society resilient enough to withstand even attacks by a highly capable cyber power. Not all threats are the proximate work of a nation-state. During a panel discussion on the conference's first day, Carbon Black's Mike Viscuso emphasized the sheer size of the criminal underground at work in cyberspace. The underground cyber economy is now larger, he emphasized, than the illicit drug trade. In fact, it's now a better than trillion-dollar industry. He thinks that as defenses get better, and they have been getting better, the criminals will cease playing the long game because the long game will no longer pay off. They'll increasingly turn to smash-and-grab attacks. He compared the criminals to a caged lion. They're confined and increasingly hungry, and they won't be patient. The CyberWire will have further coverage of the summit later this week. Security firm Sophos has released a report on Megacortex, a new strain of ransomware it found last week. It doesn't appear to be spread by spam, but Sophos thinks it may well be spread by Trojans that themselves arrive by email, so the usual caution about emails and backups are in order. So far, it's not known whether the hoods are honoring ransom payments. Sophos says customers in the United States, Italy, Canada, France, the Netherlands, and Ireland have reported incidents. The criminals have the brass to suggest that they'll throw in some security consultation if the victims pay the ransom. As they put it, quote, the software's price will include a guarantee that your company will never be inconvenienced by us. You will also receive a consultation on how to improve your company's cybersecurity. This sweetening of the pot to deliver best value to the victim is another sorry instance of criminal enterprise aping legitimate ones. As researchers at IBM point out, they compete for talent, they sometimes cooperate with one another. Since almost any business will need a subcontractor at some point, they have CEOs, those CEOs hire program managers, they have goals, and they work regular hours, taking weekends off. That last point makes them sound more like large, stable firms than like scrappy startups. Anywho, to return to Megacortex, researchers seeking to explain the ransom note point out that it's likely an homage to the name of the corporation Neo worked for in the film The Matrix. Sophos suggests the ransom note reads like something voiced by Morpheus, to which we say, "What if I told you everything you've securely backed up can be restored?" Today's episode is sponsored by SRM, your first call for cybersecurity and investigations. Threats today are evolving faster than ever before, and since 2005, SRM has pioneered tailored security solutions for global corporations and their executives. Whether it's defending against cyber attacks with their award-winning team of ethical hackers and incident response specialists, or navigating the murky waters of compliance and ESG challenges, SRM's insight and straightforward advice will help you navigate complex risks and emerge more resilient. Their secret? A culture that nurtures the sharpest minds, giving them access to the newest technologies and the freedom to solve problems in new ways, enabling them to craft simple, effective solutions for your unique cyber challenges. Search Your First Call to discover how SRM can help your business. And now, a word from our sponsor, Zscaler, the leader in cloud security. Cyber attackers are using AI in creative ways to compromise users and breach organizations. In a security landscape where you must fight AI with AI, the best AI protection comes from having the best data. Zscaler has extended its Zero Trust architecture with powerful AI engines that are trained and tuned by 500 trillion daily signals. Learn more about Zscaler Zero Trust plus AI to prevent ransomware and AI attacks. Experience your world secured. Visit zscaler.com/zerotrustAI. And joining me once again is Joe Kerrigan. He is from the Johns Hopkins University Information Security Institute. Also my co-host on the Hacking Humans podcast. Joe, welcome back.
Hi, Dave.
Interesting news came from Dell about some patches that they have sent out recently. Bring us up to date here. What's going on?
So Dell has a product that they install on almost all their machines called the Support Assist Client.
Okay.
Right? And you may see this frequently. It comes up and says, hi, I'm the Support Assist Client. Let me run a scan on your computer. Let me make sure. And it is a legitimate product from Dell.
Right.
But there is a young researcher, and by young, I mean this guy is 17 years old, named Bill Demirkapi. And I hope I'm saying his last name correctly.
Right.
I'm probably butchering it, but I'm just going to call him Bill from now on.
Okay.
But he found a remote code execution. Using social engineering, you can trick somebody into running code that they shouldn't run.
Hmm. Now, let's just back up, but just for a real basic explanation, what's remote code execution?
So basically, remote code execution means I can, as an attacker, can run whatever I want on your machine.
From somewhere else.
From somewhere else. Yeah. And it's a really bad vulnerability.
Right.
Dell ships this product with the idea of helping their customers. And it probably does provide some real benefit to the customer. But we, as customers of Dell and even Dell themselves, have to realize that this increases your attack surface. All these pre-installed applications and bloatware that you get from these computer manufacturers increases the vulnerability surface of your computer when you get it out of the box.
Yeah. The Support Assist Client, I mean, one of the things it was supposed to be keeping tabs on was security.
Correct. It was supposed to be keeping an update on security.
Yeah.
And it in itself is insecure. Well, it's software, right?
Yeah.
So it can have vulnerabilities in it just as well.
Mm.
I want to talk about something with Bill. Bill is a sharp young man. He's going to Rochester Institute of Technology next year, which is a good school.
Mm-hmm.
And Bill has done a bang-up job here.
Mm.
All right. And he has done this exactly right. The first thing he did, he discovered this vulnerability back in October. He has a timeline on his webpage where he shares the write-up about the vulnerability.
Okay.
And it takes Dell about a month to confirm the vulnerability. Right? Then it takes Dell about to the end of April to finally patch the vulnerability.
Okay.
And Bill did not discuss the vulnerability. He kept the vulnerability confidential until Dell had fixed it, which is great. So thank you, Bill, for your work. It's great.
And we assume that he had had some back and forth with Dell.
Correct.
About this.
I'm sure that that went on.
Yeah.
I would like to say to Dell that 5 months is kind of a long time to let this vulnerability linger.
Mm-hmm.
The fact that Bill found it and notified you of it is great, and you guys are lucky that happened, but you don't know who else has found this vulnerability and not disclosed it to you.
Mm-hmm.
And that means that if there's a good chance that somebody else out there had it, they had it for 5 months, they really didn't need to have it.
Hmm.
I think this vulnerability should have been fixed a lot faster than 5 months.
Yeah, well, and I wonder, you know, what's going on behind the scenes. I wonder, was there any way that Dell could establish how often this was being used, if at all, out in the wild, if there was any mechanism
That's
for that?
That's a good point.
Yeah.
And another good point that counters my argument about this taking so long is that Dell has a pretty big configuration management issue with this product. They have to push it out and make sure it works on all the devices that they're going to deploy it to.
Right.
Right. So there is a big issue, and all these devices are different. They have hundreds of model numbers. Some of these machines are years old. How do you know if your fix is going to, you know, make it so that these things don't work anymore? It's a difficult problem for Dell to have.
Yeah.
So maybe I'm being harsh on Dell. I don't know.
That's okay.
I still think 5 months is a long time, though.
Yeah, yeah. Well, and so I guess the bottom line here is that if you are running a Dell system,
right,
go in and check to see what version of this support assist client you're running.
Right. Make sure you have the latest.
Yeah, make sure you have the latest one.
Right.
All right. Well, Joe Kerrigan, thanks for joining us.
My pleasure, Dave.
Don't struggle to align your organization's cybersecurity with business risk. Get the only solution that goes beyond reacting to threats with vulnerability and risk monitoring. You need the next evolution of MDR, and only Critical Start delivers it. Critical Start doesn't just monitor and respond to threats. They put you in control by detecting suspicious activities, quickly responding to contain threats, and identifying your most critical assets and protecting them against vulnerabilities and exposures. With continuous visibility, expert guidance, and measurable risk reduction, Critical Start has redefined what it means to manage cyber risk. Demonstrate provable security maturity to your leadership while positioning your program to achieve the greatest risk reduction per dollar spent. Stop fearing risk and start managing it with Critical Start. Visit CriticalStart.com and request a demo today. That's CriticalStart.com.
And that's the CyberWire. For links to all of today's stories, check out our daily briefing at thecyberwire.com. And for professionals and cybersecurity leaders who want to stay abreast of this rapidly evolving field, sign up for CyberWire Pro. It'll save you time and keep you informed. Listen for us on your Alexa smart speaker, too. The CyberWire podcast is proudly produced in Maryland out of the startup studios of Data Tribe, where they're co-building the next generation of cybersecurity teams and technologies. Our amazing CyberWire team is Elliot Peltzman, Peru Prakash, Stefan Vaziri, Kelsey Bond, Tim Nodar, Joe Kerrigan, Carol Terrio, Ben Yellen, Nick Vilecki, Gina Johnson, Bennett Moe, Chris Russell, John Petrick, Jennifer Iben, Rick Howard, Peter Kilpie, and I'm Dave Bittner. Thanks for listening. We'll see you back here tomorrow. And now a word from our sponsor, SpyCloud, the leader in operationalizing cybercrime analytics. Traditional threat intelligence is a thing of the past. Cyber criminals are stealing vast amounts of credentials, session cookies, and financial data every day, and it's hard to keep up. SpyCloud is the trusted partner businesses turn to fully understand their darknet exposure risk and neutralize threats before it's too late.
SpyCloud alerts your organization as soon as an employee or customer's data appears on the dark net, so you can act faster than bad actors to prevent cyber attacks like ransomware, session hijacking, account takeover, and online fraud. With insights from the industry's largest repository of recaptured data, protect the digital identities and systems most important to your business. Get your free corporate darknet exposure report at spycloud.com/cyberwire and see what information criminals have in their hands today. That's spycloud.com/cyberwire.